What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hello and welcome to Art Muse, a podcast that aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret well-known works of art by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. While these women's faces are familiar to viewers around the world, their identities have been largely forgotten. Together, we will explore the important lives and legacy of the female muse and appreciate these works of art from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. Is the muse in actuality just as, if not more, important than the artists themselves? And I'm your host, Grace Anna. If I were to ask you, who is the world's most famous modern artist? Chances are that you would answer Pablo Picasso. Now, if I were to ask you, who was the mastermind behind Picasso's most revered works? How many of you would know her name? Today, I share with you the story of Dora Maar, known as the woman with the thousand faces. In their almost 10-year-long relationship, Picasso painted Dora Maar countless times, most famously as his Weeping Woman. What is lesser known is that their relationship coincided with the peak of Pablo Picasso's artistic career, and many of Picasso's greatest works, like Guernica, would have never existed without Dora's creative genius. But Dora Maar was much more than Picasso's lover and muse. By the time Picasso met Dora, she was already an established photographer and one of the few women allowed into the Surrealist movement. Her photographs were incredibly inventive, dreamlike worlds that she constructed in the darkroom. She was a fiercely passionate political advocate and an active member of some of the most important leftist political groups of her time. She had a heated love affair with the great philosopher Georges Bataille, and she was one of the strongest characters of the 20th century. Her story involves some of the biggest names of art history and spans her long life, from her artistic beginnings to her final years as a recluse. In this episode, we honor Dora Maar as her own artist and woman, independent from Picasso. In doing so, perhaps Picasso's Weeping Woman has the last laugh after all. Henriette Theodora Markovich, later known as Dora Maar, was born on November 22, 1907, in Paris. She was the daughter of Joseph Markovich, an architect of Croatian descent. By some accounts, Joseph was Jewish, although Dora denied this later in her life. Her mother, Julie Voisin, was a French Catholic and owned a fashion boutique. When Dora was 3 years old, she moved with her family to Buenos Aires, where she spent the majority of her childhood. Her father secured commissions for several important buildings in the city, including the embassy for the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Growing up in Argentina, Dora learned to speak fluent Spanish, an attribute that would impress Picasso many years later. Her family lived in a colonial-style villa on a tree-lined street, but the inside was far less picturesque. The house had limited space, making the living quarters cramped and uncomfortable. Dora had just a glass door separating her bedroom from her parents, and she suffered from the lack of privacy. Through the glass, she bore witness to frequent fights between her parents, who were quite clearly unhappily married. Dora was a dreamy and introverted child who, perhaps as a means of survival, would escape into her own imagination. She showed signs of artistic talent from an early age, spending her time drawing and painting. As a child, Dora danced to the beat of her own drum. She was left-handed, and despite schooling, continued to use her left hand to make her art. She asked that her parents call her Dora, and she expressed to them early on her desire to become a painter. In 1926, at the age of 19, Dora and her family moved back to Paris. Eager to pursue her career in the arts, Dora took up studies at the École de Photographie, where she began to develop her craft in photography. She then enrolled at the Académie Julien, where women were able to receive the same training as male students at the equivalent institution, École des Beaux-Arts. Because the students at Académie Julien were not in the same room as men, they were permitted to study from the nude model, a rarity for women studying the arts at her time. Through her studies, Dora divided her time between painting and photography, showing a passion and talent for both mediums. During this time, Dora attended classes at the painter André Lhote's studio, where she befriended fellow classmate Henri Cartier-Bresson. And in fact, it was Bresson who encouraged Dora to pursue a career of photography rather than painting. Bresson must have seen in Dora a rare talent, a noteworthy compliment coming from one of the most famous photographers of our day. There were also more logistical reasons for Dora to pursue photography over painting. For one, it was much easier for a woman of her time to succeed in photography, as painting was still male-dominated. But more than that, photography was an exciting new medium that was in the midst of an artistic renaissance. And Dora herself would soon continue to revolutionize the medium with her inventive works. Upon graduating, Dora approached the photographer Man Ray to ask if he was looking for an assistant. Although he turned down her request, as he never used assistants, he did promise to be at Dora's disposal if she ever needed advice. Man Ray would be a continued presence in Dora's life, particularly during her later relationship with Pablo Picasso. But it was Dora's ambition as a young artist that first put her on Man Ray's radar. To launch her artistic career, Dora officially shortened her name to Dora Maar. Even in her earliest surviving photographs, we see the unique sense of complexity and drama that would become her signature mark. In a self-portrait from the late 1920s, Dora photographed her reflection in a mirror. Yet her face is obscured by a fan in the forefront of the frame, creating a sense of mystery that leaves the viewer wishing to see more. Dora's photographs were published for the first time in 1931 in a book on the monastery on Mont Saint-Michel. The 72 photographs capture the monastery and surrounding mountain from jarring perspectives, playing with our sense of reality. In one photograph taken from high above, we see the back of a gargoyle lurching over the facade, making the stone figure pulse with life. The photographs have a simultaneous sense of drama and humor, concerning us and amusing us all at once. The project was made in partnership with Pierre Keffer, who Dora set up a studio with shortly after. The studio, named the Keffer Maar Studio, was located on the grounds of the Keffer family home, just west of Paris. Pierre's father was an established musician and offered Dora and Pierre access to elite clientele. Pierre spent his early career as an art director and set designer for films, and likely focused on the staging and lighting aspect of their projects, whereas Dora did the bulk of the camera work. While Pierre offered the space and connections, it was undoubtedly Dora who took charge of their joint enterprise. The space became a playground of sorts for Maar and Keffer to create unique images. And the studio even had a pool in its center. The pair created witty and surreal photographs that were mainly commissioned by fashion magazines. There's a sense of playfulness in these photos, and we can imagine the two artists experimenting together with excitement. These photos were also the beginning of Dora manipulating and constructing images in the darkroom. In one, a female celebrity's head is replaced with a star, a double entendre on the meaning of stardom. In another, a miniature ship glides across waves of hair, to advertise a hair oil. The Kafer Mar Studio was the perfect opportunity for Dora to develop her voice as a photographer. But after a few years, the studio closed. During this time, Dora shared a studio with the French-Hungarian photographer Brassai. Brassai later recalled their time together, saying Dora would, quote, stalk her subject as a huntress around her prey, as she searched for the most telling detail. Brassai and Dora would exhibit their work together, and through Brassai, Dora came in contact with the biggest artists in Paris. It was an exciting time of collective artistic innovation, and Dora was thriving in it. With the help of her father, Dora was able to open her own studio in 1934. This gave Dora the ability to focus on her creative work, rather than depending on outside commissions. It is during this time that we see some of Dora's most originative work. In many, she played with photograms, a technique in which you place objects directly onto light-sensitive paper. She also took a series of nude portraits of the famed model of the Surrealists, Asha Granaratov. The photos of Asha are uncanny and dreamlike. In one, she wears an eerie mask. In another, she is swallowed by her own monstrous shadow. The same year she opened her studio, Dora traveled to Barcelona and London with just her Rolleiflex camera as her companion. She photographed the winding staircases of Gaudi's La Sagrada Familia, which she would later use for photo collages. She also did a series of street photography, focusing on exposing the devastating effects of poverty caused by the Depression. In one striking image from London, we see an old man still wearing his suit and top hat, begging for money, as he grasps on to as much dignity as he can. And so Dora produced photographs across the disciplines. Portraits, fashion photographs, advertisements, politically charged street photography, and even erotic images. She constructed dreamlike worlds, whether through staging or experimentation in the darkroom, blurring the lines between reality and fantasy. As a woman, Dora had to continually prove herself to the still male-dominated worlds of photography and publishing, and it took an immense amount of bravery and confidence to excel to the extent she did. Dora was not just able to infiltrate the Parisian art scene, but she was one of the few women allowed into the highly exclusive Surrealist movement. In order to be a member of the group, one had to be nominated, and the group had its own jury, which ousted artists who did not live up to their standards. Even the artist Giacometti was excommunicated. This makes it all the more impressive that Mar remained in their circle for several years. Mar's photographs became emblems of the movement, capturing the essence of Surrealism in her reality-bending photos. Between the years of 1934 and 1937, Dora exhibited her photographs with the Surrealists in both London and Paris, alongside Salvador Dali and Man Ray, just to name a few. Dora was actually the only of these artists to exhibit her work in all six of the Surrealist International exhibits. Her photographs from her time with the Surrealists have what leader André Breton referred to as a, quote, bewildering strangeness. In one famous one from 1934, Dora collaged her hand coming out of a conch shell. In another, titled Portrait of Ubu, a mysterious and monstrous creature creeps its way to the viewer. Some have speculated that Dora used an armadillo fetus, but no one knows for certain, as Dora never revealed her secret, not even on her deathbed. But she was not just involved through her art. Dora also signed the Surrealist manifestos and would join in on their heated debates over art and politics. Her bold outfits and broody character made a great fit with the group of outlandish artists. Dora would famously paint her nails to the color of her mood, and wore elaborate hats and lipstick to match. Her black hair and raspy low voice gave her a certain mystique, which was enhanced by her interest in transgression and mysticism. She had an equally bold character, known for her hot temper and stubbornness. She was unconventional, independent, and tough, confident in her immense talent as a photographer and her ability to seduce men with just one glance of her light blue eyes. The Surrealists were not the only group that Dora was active in. Dora was also heavily involved with leftist political activist groups, attending meetings and signing their manifestos. With fascism on the rise, there was great momentum behind the French left to advocate for the rights of the working class. Dora was a member of the anti-fascist group Appel à la Lutte, as well as October, a leftist group of creatives who sought to make their theater more affordable to workers. And it was through her involvement with another of these anti-nationalistic groups, Masses, that Dora first met the philosopher Georges Bataille, now famous for his work on eroticism. Dora was attracted to Bataille's political fervor and intellectualism, and in 1933, the two entered a steamy 5-month-long relationship. Their affair was notoriously sexually adventurous, but it was also a connection grounded in a shared view of an ideal world. Though short-lived, their relationship gives us a sense of the exciting romantic life Dora had prior to meeting Pablo Picasso. When Dora Maar met Picasso in 1936, she was already an established photographer associated with the leading artistic movement, a fierce political advocate, and a sexually confident woman who had affairs with notable figures. In fact, at the time of their first encounter, Dora was actually more famous than André Breton and Versailles. Dora by no means needed Picasso, but she certainly wouldn't throw away the challenge of capturing the attention of the infamous artist. Their meeting is almost a surrealist fantasy in and of itself, a sultry mix of eroticism and eeriness. In early January 1936, Picasso entered the Café des Deux Magots with his friend Paul Eluard. Upon settling down, he noticed a dark-haired beauty, dressed in all black, holding a cigarette and holder between her gloved fingers. Though she pretended not to notice, Dora felt Picasso's gaze on her and began to drive a penknife between her fingers into the wooden table as a little show. Each time she missed, a drop of blood would stain her embroidered glove. Enthralled by her act of danger, Picasso approached Dora, speaking to her in French. Dora instead replied in fluent Spanish, knowing that it was Picasso's native tongue. For the second time that day, Dora had successfully stunned the painter. As they left the cafe together, Picasso asked to keep Dora's bloody gloves as a souvenir. The knife and bloody gloves feel like props of one of Dora's surrealist still lives. Dora was 28 years old and Picasso nearly 35. Though 7 years his younger, it's clear that Dora was the master manipulator behind their meeting. And some believe that Dora may have deliberately went to the cafe that day to wait for Picasso, who frequented it regularly. Either way, once Dora saw the painter walk through the cafe doors, she knew exactly what to do to make her presence unforgettable. A calculated performance that would forever change the lives of both artists. Perhaps intimidated by Dora's forwardness, Picasso left town immediately after their meeting. As the author Jean-Charles Gatteau wrote, quote, "Dora withstood, without batting an eye, Picasso's stare, and he was the one to flee." But Picasso had much more than Dora's fierce stare to worry about. At the time of their meeting, Picasso had hit a low point in both his professional and personal life. His marriage to his first wife, Olga Kolova, ended due to his affair with Marie-Therese Walter, who he impregnated. Having frayed relationships with both women, Picasso was needing artistic inspiration. And what better than a new and exciting lover to inspire him? Dora and Picasso would meet again that August in the south of France, where they would spend the rest of the summer together, accompanied by a superstar-filled group of artists, including Man Ray, Andre Breton, and Lee Miller. Though technically Picasso's posse, Dora was well acquainted with these artists due to her own career and involvement with the Surrealists. Each day, the group of artists would bask in the sun, swim in the sea, discuss politics, make art, and take long siestas. We can only imagine how exciting of a time this must have been for Dora. The flames of her relationship with Picasso just igniting, in company with the biggest artists of her age, and engaging in heated conversations about politics and art. It was a period of creative co-collaboration, and no one was more collaborative than Dora and Picasso, who would stay up all night making art together. Upon returning to Paris, Dora found Picasso a new studio and moved into an apartment just around the corner. She would come to his studio to make art together, and he would come to hers for lunch and dinner. Though they never formally lived together, the two became inseparable. Dora became Picasso's main mistress and was heavily involved in his life, taking the place of previous lovers Marie-Therese Walter and Olga Kolova. Although, as we will see, he did not stop seeing them completely. The two shared an intense passion for the arts and began to impress upon the other their artistic visions. Picasso encouraged Dora to take up painting again, sharing with her the cubist techniques he is so famous for. Dora took portraits of Picasso and photographed his statues and sculptured stones. She brought him into the darkroom and taught him various photographic processes. Together, they made photographic experiments with photograms and prints. Dora inspired in Picasso an outstanding period of creativity, and their relationship coincided with the peak of Picasso's career. Picasso also became completely absorbed by Dora's image. He painted many portraits of Dora in the beginning year of their relationship. In his famous Portrait of Dora Maar, painted in 1937, we see an abstracted Maar staring confidently at the viewer, with her signature red fingernails and lipstick. Her strong personality and assertive presence is palpable in these portraits, as is her taste for fashion, showcasing her various stylish scarves, hats, and outfits. Her hands, always shown with painted nails, have eye-catching gestures, playing a prominent part within the composition. We also see this in Man Ray's portrait of Dora, taken in the same year. Her hands covering her forehead, while her eyes peek through her fingers. The same hands that Dora used to make her photos became iconic staples in portraits of her, her unique way of leaving her mark. Dora and Picasso's relationship not only spanned the peak of Picasso's career, but also the darkest years of European history. The rise of fascism was increasingly being felt. In July of 1936, while Dora and Picasso were enjoying their summer in the south of France, General Franco's army revolted against Spain's democratic government, leading to the outbreak of civil war. By early 1937, Picasso's birthplace of Malaga was taken by right-wing troops. Picasso was devastated and found comfort in his ability to discuss the political situation with Dora, who was not only highly informed, but whose political advocacy began to ignite Picasso's own anger. On April 28, 1937, the town of Guernica was devastated by an aerial bombing attack, killing more than 1,500 civilians. It was Dora who first showed Picasso the images of the massacre, and she was even more incensed than he at the sheer brutality of the attack. Picasso had been commissioned to paint a mural for the Spanish Pavilion in the 1937 exposition in Paris, and with Dora's encouragement, Picasso knew he had the subject for his next greatest work. And so Picasso began to paint his famous Guernica, where he sought to capture the horror of not only the Spanish Civil War, but of war at large. It is one of the most powerful works of art ever to be created. And we can see the influence of Dora all over the work. The politically charged subject matter was no doubt inspired by Dora's political views. The trademark style in black and white was an allude to Dora's black and white photos, and the flash at the top of the canvas recalls the flash of her camera. And the face of the central woman holding a lantern has Dora's characteristics. We can actually see the work of Dora's own hand in the iconic horse, which she painted a few brushstrokes into, symbolic of Dora's hand in the making of the masterpiece as a whole. Beyond the canvas, Dora was the one who found the studio space large enough to accommodate such a big work. And she had the important task of documenting each stage of the painting's progress, her photos providing a visual record of Guernica's metamorphosis. It was the first time that Picasso allowed anyone to photograph his work in progress. In fact, the photographer Brassai stepped aside to allow Dora to be the main and only photographer, acknowledging her unparalleled involvement on both a conceptual and compositional level. The painting was so big that Dora needed to employ photographic tricks to fit the entire work into the frame. She climbed ladders and photographed the work from plunging perspectives. Her photos were published in an art journal and still today provide an invaluable insight into the making of this historic work of art. It can be said without a doubt that Guernica would have never existed had it not been for Dora Maar. How did it feel to be behind one of the most powerful works spanning all of art history? What was Dora thinking as she painted the horse's mane with her own hand? As she took each of the historic photos of the painting? As she saw Picasso paint her own face onto the canvas? And as he made the artistic choice to turn the painting black and white, just like her photos? We can only imagine how exhilarating this must have been for Dora, knowing that she was the real mastermind behind Guernica. It is after the completion of Guernica that Picasso began portraying Dora Maar as the weeping woman over and over again. He depicted Dora with tears over 60 times, her tears being almost obsessively captured over the course of the next few years. In his most famous example, painted just 1 week after he finished Guernica, we see a colorful and abstracted Dora wearing one of her extravagant hats and a glitzy pair of earrings. But here, Dora is biting her signature fingernails in anguish, tears welling up in her eyes. She seems to almost be paralyzed by deep anxiety and fear. It's important to ask, why was Dora crying? Her tears have since been subject to much interpretation. Many have blamed Dora's tears on Pablo Picasso's emotional abusiveness, a victim to his wrath and objectification of women. It is true that Picasso continued to see both his first wife, Olga, and the mother of his child, Marie-Therese Walter, throughout his relationship with Dora. In fact, during the making of Guernica, Walter famously stormed into the studio and told Picasso, "It's either me or her," asking him to choose between the two women, to which Picasso suggested they fight it out themselves, a war over Picasso stewing as he painted his most famous picture of war. And as we will soon see, Picasso's emotional torment of Dora did eventually break her down. But what if her tears were not because of Picasso after all? Made in such close proximity to Guernica, they are almost extensions of Picasso's exploration of human suffering caused by war. Instead of a woman lovesick over a man, what if the weeping woman is a woman in distress over the outbreak of war? What if her tears are the tears of all the mothers who have lost a child, like the woman in Guernica who holds her limp baby in her hands? In fact, if you look close enough, you can see the war planes reflected in Dora's pupils in this most famous version of the Weeping Woman. Dora's anguish is not over Picasso's infidelity, at least not yet. It's grief over the atrocities of war. And in these portraits, we see Dora's immense compassion for human suffering. As Europe was on the brink of World War II, wouldn't you be weeping too? The portraits began to shift Dora's identity from that of a confident photographer to a weeping woman, a tragic figure swallowed by her own emotions. The narrative still survives today, and it is Dora's tears that she is now most remembered for. But to read Dora's tears merely in relation to her affair with Picasso is limiting and degrading. Instead, how can we see her tears as empowering? Rather than seeing a woman broken by a man, we see her desire for a better world. This sense of empowerment is supported by the fact that Dora made many of her own versions of weeping women. Someone with as strong of a personality as Dora had would not have painted her own face crying if it had been in any way demeaning. Her versions of the weeping women are far from self-pitying, but show the agency she took over her own image. She is making clear that her tears are nothing to be ashamed of, and she proudly shows them off for us. That summer, Dora and Picasso returned to the south of France to once again join their crew of friends and fellow artists. The summer was one of sexual freedom and play, as they would allegedly exchange bedmates often. The group even adopted a monkey that would join them at the beach, at meals, and even at their hotel. This second summer altogether would be one of the last moments of lightheartedness, certainly in Dora and Picasso's relationship, but also in Europe at large. World War II just on the horizon. In July 1938, Dora moved to Côte d'Azur with Picasso as they awaited news of the political situation. In his Night Fishing at Antibes, Picasso painted Dora at night, eating an ice cream as she looked over the water at the fishermen. The painting's ominous tone feels symbolic of the more general sentiment of fear as the world looked on with bated breath. After a brief stay in Paris so that Picasso could obtain permanent residency before the political situation got too frayed, Dora and Picasso moved to Royan, where she channeled her anxiety over the state of the world into her painting. It was a particularly fruitful time in Dora's career, and she made several portraits of Picasso in various styles. But her art could not save her completely from what was overall an immensely dark time. As the political situation intensified, so did Dora's personal life. It became increasingly unbearable that Picasso spent half his time with Marie-Thérèse Walter and their daughter Maya. This was made all the worse when Dora went to a doctor in Royan and found out that she was infertile. Imagining Picasso playing with his daughter from his other lover must have stung particularly deep. But the worst was yet to come. On June 16, 1940, France was defeated by German troops, and the Nazis began to occupy Paris. Not wanting to abandon their city, Dora and Picasso moved back to Paris, in a Nazi-occupied zone. Dora bore witness to the Parisian Jews losing all of their civil rights and being forced to wear a yellow star. By July of 1942, Dora may have watched from her window as 13,000 Jews were rounded up and taken to concentration camps. If Dora Maar, born Markowitz, was indeed Jewish, she was protected from the Nazis and her life was spared. Was Dora Jewish? Was it Picasso who had protected her? How did it feel as she watched the Jewish communities of Paris march to their death right in front of her eyes? In the heat of the war, Dora and Picasso's relationship began to shatter. Both prone to extreme emotion, the pressures of the political situation caused the couple to hit a breaking point. It was getting harder and harder for Dora to share Picasso with Marie-Therese Walter. Picasso would play mind games with both women, like buying them identical dresses and then switching the card so that each knew that he had bought the other the same dress. He would paint Marie-Therese in Dora's clothes, or Dora with Marie's flowers, and he would daunt Dora about being infertile. Picasso famously once said, quote, "There are only two kinds of women, goddesses and doormats." And it seems that Dora was being treated like the latter. Picasso's portraits of Dora from this time convey this tension. Many of the photos have a violent undertone. Dora is severely deformed and grotesque, as if she is coming apart. In his Seated Woman in a Garden, we see Dora on an angular chair, surrounded by zigzagging branches that trap her within the frame. Her dress seems to weigh her down with its many layers. Some have even likened the chair a torturing mechanism. These portraits embody Dora's own emotional unraveling and how trapped she must have felt under the grips of Picasso. And while Dora was drowning in her overbearing relationship and witnessing some of the darkest acts of human history, Dora was also struck with personal tragedy. Dora was on the phone with her mother one evening in 1942, when her mother suddenly collapsed and fell silent. Dora screamed for her mother to answer, but there was no response on the other end. Because of the war, the city had a strict nightly curfew, and Dora had to wait the whole night in fear to find out if her mother was alive or not. The next morning, she raced over to her mother's house to find her collapsed on the floor, cold as ice. While she did not always get along with her mother, Dora began to feel a crippling sense of guilt, worried that her death was her fault. Unable to reach her mother in a timely fashion, her mother became yet another casualty of the war. In his very last portrait of Dora, made just a few months after her mother's death, Picasso painted Dora's face without abstraction for the first time in years. She is no longer deconstructed or wears extravagant outfits. Rather, Dora sits in a demure outfit and stares vacantly at the viewer, as if she's completely shut down. Grieving the war, her relationship with Picasso, and now her mother's death, Dora's expression in this simple portrait says it all, and we come face to face with a shattered spirit. The following year marked the beginning of the official end of Picasso and Dora's relationship. Picasso met the painter François Gillot, who, despite being 40 years his younger, would replace Dora as his next lover. When on November 11, 1944, the world rejoiced over the end of the war, Dora had little to rejoice in her personal life. Despite the many warnings from her friends, some calling Picasso her demon lover, Dora tried to keep their fading love alive for another 2 years, but it was obvious that Picasso had moved on. In one of their last encounters, Picasso invited himself and François Gillot to Dora's studio. Gillot recalls that Dora turned to Picasso and said, quote, "You never loved anyone in your life. You don't know how to love." Perhaps out of guilt, Picasso gifted Dora a house in the south of France. While the house was large, it was in poor condition, friends even recalling that some of the ceilings had collapsed. We can imagine that as Dora walked through the cracked walls and broken ceilings, she felt the pain of her own internal broken walls. As Dora wrote in 1946, quote, "I walk alone in a vast landscape. It's fine weather, but there is no sun, no hour. For a long time now, no friend or passerby. I walk around, but I speak alone." Despite the emotional pain, the end of the war did provide Dora the opportunity to exhibit her paintings on her own. Dora had a solo show in both 1945 and 1946, where she showed her still lifes and waterscapes of the Seine for the first time. Her still lifes concentrated on one object and had an air of solitude about them. The work showed the slow detachment from Picasso, and the works were no longer in Picasso's style, but became her own. But even with the attention her artistic career was gaining, Dora could not escape the aftermath of the slow unraveling of her life over the last few years, and she continued to be hit with tragedy after tragedy. In November of 1946, just after speaking with her good friend Noosh Elulard on the phone, Noosh collapsed and died from a cerebral hemorrhage. This was the second loved one who died on or just after Dora had spoken with them on the phone. And we can only imagine how triggering this must have been for Dora, on top of her shock and grief. Noosh had modeled for Dora during her career before Picasso, and was with her during those two iconic summers in the south of France. It must have felt that Dora was losing everyone she loved and the life she knew all at once. Haunted by the ghosts of the war, her mother, and now her friend Noosh, Dora began to experience a psychiatric breakdown. She started to have hallucinations, and quite a few public outbursts were reported. In one instance, she was discovered naked in the stairway of her apartment building, and in another, she needed to be physically removed from a cinema after causing an eruptive disturbance. The photographer Brassai recalled a time when Picasso and a group of artists were having lunch at a cafe. Dora, who was invited, came hours late, sat down for 2 minutes, and shouted, "I've had enough. I can't stay. I'm going," and stormed off. Picasso and Paul Elulard rushed after her. When they came back close to an hour later, Picasso's friends said they had never seen him so distressed. Dora's condition was so upsetting that Paul Elulard allegedly smashed a chair to bits in dismay. Dora was soon after taken to a psychiatric hospital, where she spent 3 weeks in excruciating conditions. She was subjected to a series of electric shock treatments, which we can only imagine exasperated her emotional state. After an intervention by a friend, Dora was moved into a private clinic where she began to get treatment from the psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan. Dora's condition was so severe that Lacan reportedly was at a loss over how to help her. After several failed techniques, he began to lean into Dora's interest in mysticism, encouraging her to develop a spiritual practice. Dora explored the occult, practiced Buddhism for some time, and eventually settled into Catholicism, which she continued to devoutly follow for the rest of her life. Over the course of 2 years, and with the help of spirituality, Dora was able to recover slowly. Picasso, rather than taking responsibility for his role in Dora's breakdown, blamed her interest in the occult and involvement with the surrealists, who he claimed encouraged irrational thinking. In a poem from 1947, Dora wrote, quote, "Facing the mirror, I question myself about the night to come. Let the time pass, let me withdraw, let the mirror be empty for always." After witnessing some of the worst of the war, losing her mother, being abandoned by Picasso for a woman 20 years her younger, and then losing a best friend, it's no wonder that Dora had a psychiatric break. Feeling more like herself again, Dora enjoyed a social period, spending time with creatives like the painter Balthus. Friends noted after her treatment that Dora was once again playful and lively. Despite how hard the last few years had been, friends admired Dora's poise, never presenting herself as a victim. She continued to go deeper and deeper into her religious practice, which gave her a newfound sense of faith. And it was this faith that helped her survive Picasso's continued torture of her. In 1954, he surprised Dora by inviting himself to dinner at Dora's house in southern France, the one he had gifted her. All through the night, Picasso went out of his way to embarrass and insult Dora. It took an immense amount of self-confidence and grounding for Dora to get through the evening, not giving Picasso the satisfaction of turning her into a weeping woman for the second time in her life. A few years later, when Picasso was working on publishing a book of his sketches, he suggested to the editor that they ask Dora for a sketchbook of his that she still had. When the editor approached Dora, she became reluctant. After some persuasion, Dora handed over the book with tears in her eyes. The sketchbook was filled with drawings of Dora's crotch. Picasso was clearly trying to humiliate her. Up until Picasso's death in 1973, the two engaged in a silent war of gifts. One time, Picasso sent Dora a chair with steel rods that would injure you if you sat upon it, and Dora rebutted by sending him a rusty shovel in return. When Picasso died, a spiked ring with the label "Poor Dora Maar" was found in his home, a final menacing act that Picasso did not live long enough to complete. How did Dora feel when Picasso died at the age of 91? Was she relieved that the man who had shattered her heart was no longer alive? That his relentless torment would finally be put to rest? Was there any part of her sad to lose the painter? As she walked around her home, still filled with the mementos from their relationship, did Dora have any warm memories to remember? By the 1950s, Dora became more and more reclusive. She became immersed in both her religious and artistic practices, which seemed to comfort her loneliness. But she also seemed to become more and more moody. James Lord, one of her few companions she had late in life, wrote in a friend breakup letter to her, quote, "How alone you must feel. And I muse sometimes with sadness upon the solitude you seem to want to build about yourself like a cage. What can you expect? Pride is a dish to be eaten alone." This letter, and Dora's subsequent seclusion, paint the picture of a woman isolating herself from the world. Dora split her time between her apartment in Paris and her home in southern France. In Paris, her living room was converted into an artist studio, and she would shut herself away working for days on end. In the south of France, she kept her home sparse, almost with the simplicity of a nunnery. The house accommodated a large studio space, where Dora was able to focus on her work without distraction. Dora did have some human interaction at this time. She opened her home to the nuns at the church she was involved with, and she did go to service every Sunday. She also had lengthy phone conversations with her few loyal friends, though if they tried to come see her at her home, she would refuse to come to the door. It was these correspondences and her artwork that kept her company in her later age. During these years, Dora could be seen riding her motorbike out to paint watercolors of the French countryside. These works, described as angelic and sadly romantic landscapes, were exhibited in a gallery in Paris in 1957, where they were well received. She sketched the stained glass windows of the churches she attended for Mass. Her simply decorated house was a perfect backdrop for concentrated still lives, which she continued to make. She wrote private poems that reflected her inner emotional state. The final years of Dora's life were marked with even more seclusion. In 1989, the art dealer Marcel Fleiss was one of the few people allowed into Dora's apartment to organize an exhibition of her work. He described an almost shockingly messy scene. Plates piled so high in the kitchen sink that they had accumulated dust. Books scattered everywhere, and bugs scurrying across the floor. The mementos from Dora's long and exciting life were packed into her apartment. their presence almost like ghosts with long-lost memories. Fleiss did stage a successful exhibition of Dora's work in 1990. Dora, despite her age, insisted on approving the preface for the show's catalog, correcting dates and facts. She insisted that her work was just as good as Man Ray and Cartier-Bresson, and that the prices should reflect that. Despite her involvement, Dora did not attend the opening, likely to avoid being seen. Instead, she came to the show a few days later dressed in disguise, as she enjoyed her show in secret. One of the few people to see Dora in the end of her life was the art critic John Richardson. He didn't believe that Dora became a recluse because she didn't want contact with the outside world. He noted that she continued to have long conversations with friends on the phone. He believed that Dora shied away from socializing out of insecurity. Curled over with painful arteriosclerosis, Dora may have not wanted to be seen in such a vulnerable state. Richardson remembered that when Dora did receive guests, she would spend hours trying to put on a Chanel suit in anticipation of their visit. Call it vanity or dignity, Dora would rather preserve the image of who she was than be judged or rejected for who she had become. Dora no longer took the train from Paris to the south of France, but hired her chauffeur to drive her the whole way. She would keep him waiting for up to 2 hours as she packed her clothes into plastic bags, rather than the beautiful pieces of luggage she owned from her youth. She became progressively anxious about money in her late years, causing her homes to further deteriorate from lack of upkeep. And she was known to have a bad temper, often angry, and could be quite domineering. Her political views, which had at one point been extremely leftist, became right-winged, complaining that women shouldn't be doctors and lawyers. And during meetings with other residents in her apartment building, she would often end up screaming at her neighbors, causing them to fear her. This outwardly aggressive behavior was perhaps a symptom of the inner turmoil that Dora's poems written in private describe. Guilt and self-judgment haunt these late poems. In a poem from this time, only discovered recently, Dora writes, quote, "In the secret of myself you have me live." Perhaps in an effort to rediscover herself in her older age, Dora returned to photography in the last years of her life, reworking and rethinking her old photographs. She created a series of photograms where she imposed objects onto her old photos. In one, she placed parsley over an old portrait, making the photo look framed in snowflakes. In another, corn kettles to look like stars. There is a sense of play in these reworked photos, in which Dora was able to reconnect with her old self. Also made in secret, Dora showed these photos to only her doctor before she died. They survived as Dora's final attempts at rewriting her own story. In 1994, at the age of 87, Dora fell in her apartment in Paris and was unable to call for help. Because of her seclusion, it was a while before she was eventually found and taken to the hospital. Even in her condition, Dora's strong personality did not abate, refusing to see certain doctors she didn't like and chasing them out the door. She eventually settled on a doctor named Rose Garcia, who had studied art history in her youth and was one of the few doctors that Dora got along with. After this fall, Dora would spend the next 3 years of her life bedridden. Confined to her bed, she would doodle on little bits of paper. She still read extensively, her mind never slowing down despite her physical condition. She listened to Mass every Sunday on the radio. She used a spyglass to see things in the distance and a magnifying glass to see things closer to her. And she had a series of strings wrapped around different items to pull them over. When she needed her doctor Rose, she would clatter 2 spoons against a saucepan. It's clear, even in the most fragile of moments, Dora remained as self-sufficient as she could, a firecracker up until the end. In these last years in bed, Dora maintained a somewhat active social life, mostly through the phone, though she did befriend her neighbor June Jones, who she would practice her English with. Her employees in her countryside home said that Dora would phone often, asking about their family and keeping up with each member. Other than visits from her neighbor and her doctor, the phone was Dora's only connection to the outside world. Her doctor remembered Dora being lively and full of laughter on these calls, free from the fear that she would be seen in her deteriorated state. In 1995, just 2 years before her death, Dora had a major show in Valencia, the largest show devoted solely to her work to take place in her lifetime. Though she was unable to see it herself, we can imagine how proud Dora must have been, knowing that her work was beginning to be recognized in the way that it deserved. This must have provided some ease as she faced the end of her life. Knowing that she did not have much time left, Dora asked her Dr. Rose to take her back to her studio so that she could see her paintings one last time. She held on to Rose for support as she signed any works that lacked her signature. How did it feel for Dora to take one last look at her life's work? Which paintings was she most proud of? Did she have any regrets? Or was she filled with a sense of completion as she stood with her paintings for the last time? Dora Maar passed away in her apartment in Paris on July 16, 1997, at the age of 89. Dora had outlived Picasso by 24 years. She was buried a few days later alongside her parents and grandparents at a cemetery in Clamart, France. Her funeral was small, attended by her Dr. Rose, her neighbor June, and the few others who had remained in her life at the end, such as her dealer Marcel Fleiss. Dora left behind not only her incredible legacy, but the majority of her paintings, photographs, and drawings. She also had an impressive collection of books, as well as the many original Picasso works that Dora had accumulated during their long relationship. Those Dora had named in her will as inheritors of her estate had died before her, and with no kin, her belongings were auctioned off in a series of sales in 1998. It took newspapers a shocking 10 days to even announce Dora Maar's death. And most newspapers only remembered her in relation to Picasso as his weeping woman and gravely overlooked her impressive career. And Dora was far too aware of this during her own lifetime. In a letter to a friend, she wrote in her late age, quote, "I'm still too famous as Picasso's mistress to be accepted as a painter." And at the time, she was right. While Pablo Picasso has become one of the most esteemed artists of our day, who now remembers Dora Maar? Not as Picasso's lover, but as one of the few females to be associated with the Surrealists and whose experimental photographs were emblems of the entire movement. As the political advocate whose passion is the heart and soul of Picasso's greatest work, Guernica. As a woman who devoted over 60 years of her life to painting. Fortunately, the world is beginning to wake up to the genius of Dora Maar. In 2019, the largest retrospective of Dora Maar's work was exhibited at the Centre Pompidou in Paris, and later at the Tate Modern in London. Her home in the south of France was converted into the Dora Maar House, a retreat center for artists, scholars, and writers, administered by the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. The curtain is finally being pulled back on Dora Maar to be recognized as the important artist she was. As Dora Maar herself once said, quote, "All of Picasso's portraits of me are lies. Not one is Dora Maar." Today, we honor the real Dora Maar, as she would have wanted to be remembered. The next time you look at Picasso's Weeping Woman, remember that Dora Maar was already an established photographer who was more famous than Brassailles and Breton when she first met Pablo Picasso, who Paul Elulard once wrote, quote, holds every image in her hands, who through her photography found the extraordinary in the everyday. Remember that her tears were there because she believed in a better world, which she passionately fought for through her years of political advocacy. Remember that Dora was far more than just Picasso's sitter and lover, but the creative force behind his best works, whose image and artistic input Picasso continues to profit off of. Remember her remarkable intelligence, fluent in three languages, and well-read in almost every subject matter. Remember her as the brave force of nature, who, as her friend Bernard Minaret once wrote, quote, would have been someone, a very strong personality, even if Picasso never existed. Remember the fortitude it took for her to overcome hardships that none of us should ever have to face, and her continued commitment to faith. Dora Maar once said, quote, my destiny is magnificent, whatever it seems. Today, we wipe her tears and allow Dora Maar to have the magnificent last laugh that she always knew she deserved. I hope you have enjoyed this episode on Dora Maar. I have included images, resources, and suggestions for further reading on the Art Muse website and Instagram. Art Muse is produced by Kula Production Company. Today's episode was written by me, your host, Grace Anna. Stay tuned as I continue to share the stories of the women behind some of the world's most important works of art. Until next time, bye for now.